Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Kia ora koutou, everyone, and welcome to another week of Community Zone here on 106.1 FM Wellington Access Radio. My name is Simon Howard, and coming up in the next hour, we're taking a look at the very best of what's happening across the city on stage, and I guess this week, all across the streets of the city. Yes, Cuba Duper is this weekend. Aotearoa's most creative and diverse free arts festival takes over Cuba and the surrounding streets with interactive installations, circus, cabaret, roaming dance and music, all vying for your attention. The festival director Drew James joins me in the studio now. We're going to be discussing that in just a few minutes' time. After that, we go to shows at Circa and at Bats. First up, we'll be talking to Morgana O'Reilly, a well-known stage and screen actress who you may have seen over the years in shows like Neighbours, Wentworth, Mean Mums and more. She's done a solo show, Stories About My Body, all about her life and her relationship with her body. It's been a big success and it's almost completely sold out at Circa this week. Then at Bats, Celia McDonald, a graduate of NASDA, is doing a show called A Fat Girl's Cry, which celebrates plus-size bodies on stage, performing some of Broadway's greatest hits. Celia and fellow performer Scott Christie join me from 5:35. But as the show is so packed, we won't play you a song. Now we're going to go straight into Cuba Duper. Drew James, kia ora, welcome along.
Kia ora, Simon.
Now, Cuba Duper, it's absolutely huge, and Drew is also the chief executive of the Creative Capital Arts Trust that collectively runs the New Zealand Fringe Festival as well. Let's start with the Fringe. What an amazing festival we enjoyed this year. I mean, the standard was just so high. There was art seeping out of every venue for the last month. How proud are you of Vanessa Stacey and the team for what they delivered there?
Oh, look, they've done an amazing job. And, you know, the true heroes of it, I think, are the artists, because you know, they take their own risk on those shows and come year after year. Even during the COVID, we've never lost a Fringe festival. Yeah. But people were really hanging out to do the full Fringe with, you know, venues that had full capacities. And it just went off this year. You know, having the Hannah Playhouse was an added bonus, reopening that. And, yeah, just some extraordinary work.
Yeah, it was an amazing few weeks. And incredibly, less than 2 weeks after Fringe closes, Cuba Duper takes place. Why did that late March weekend seem like the sweet spot for when this takes place?
It does seem a bit mad, doesn't it? So, yeah, I mean, I guess Cuba Duper started in, 2016, and the Fringe has been around a lot longer. And so the Fringe, from a timing point of view, works alongside, you know, what happens in Dunedin and what happens in Adelaide, so that artists are able to kind of flow from one festival to another. Cuba Duper was set because we wanted it to be the last kind of hurrah, I guess, for summer. And it's the weekend before daylight saving every year. So, and the weather's always perfect, of course, you know. But, it's great because it's kind of like the end of all of that festival seasons. And it's, a kind of, you know, exclamation mark on the end of summer.
Well, that's it, right? I mean, it feels in Wellington like from almost Waitangi Day through to Easter, it's just every weekend there's big, big events going on. And this is kind of one of the last big hurrahs, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the website for Cuba Duper describes the festival as a creative playground, blurring lines between audience and performer. How does the festival achieve that and make sure that more than 100,000 or 150,000 people have a great experience?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I mean, when we came up with the concept for Cuba Duper, which was really kind of hot on the heels of the Cuba Street Carnival, which some people will remember. You know, the carnival unfortunately finished in 2010, and then Cuba Duper, there was kind of a 5-year gap, and then Cuba Duper came up after that. One of the reasons why Cuba Duper started was because we wanted to create a sustainable festival, something mm-hmm. that really spoke to the community in Cuba Street, both the kind of residents and the businesses, but also, I guess, kind of celebrated what the Cuba Street precinct is all about. I'd spent a lot of time looking at street festivals around the world, and particularly in France, I saw these festivals where, you know, they had hundreds of thousands of people going through small alleyways, kind of opening up into squares, and I realised that one of the ways that worked was that you just kept your audience moving, and so if you offered enough, there was always something and somewhere for somebody to go. And so you weren't congregating so many people in one place. You were really kind of moving people around.
Nice. And of course, the portal is open for us to dive into another world with the festival this year. It runs from 12 noon till midnight Saturday, 11 till 6 on Sunday. And there's 44 different stages and creative zones around Cuba Street and the surrounding areas. How do you even begin to piece something that big together?
Well, I mean, we went out with expressions of interest for a starter from both artists and also the hospitality industry. Right. Again, we wanted to make, Cuba Duper weekend the best weekend for hospitality rather than the worst weekend. And so, you know, we go to San Fran and we go to the Bristol and we kind of go to, other bars and Heyday. And we talk to them about what they want to do and how they want to activate their space. So a number of the Garage Project is another good example. So in talking to those businesses and those people, we come up with a program which is not always totally programmed by us, and so we really kind of stitch it together. We run, I think, four stages, right. and program those stages. But it's it's a collaborative effort, if you like, kind of community and businesses and the festival itself.
Nice. And we'll talk about a few different areas of that now. I mean, I think of street theatre. We don't get huge amounts. We get a bit of it here in Wellington across the year. So it's quite special, right, Cuba Duper, to head down and see the creatives that live here or come in to perform at the festival. And there's also the Mammoth Space, right, which just shows off a real range of circus-style performances. We've got Laser Kiwi back for it, Colossal, El Jaguar, Tom Monckton, all performing in there at different times. That's quite an exciting space, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I'm a great lover of street theatre and also a great lover of circus and cabaret. And there are those artists. There's some fantastic artists based in Wellington and New Zealand, which people don't see enough of, I think, anyway. And Colossal, not only performing but also creating that mammoth space and kind of like hosting other artists to come in is fantastic. We've got an aerial and antics stage as well, which is kind of dedicated to aerial work. So that's being set up in Gusney Street.
Oh, nice.
It's really about kind of, creating that opportunity for those artists to really shine.
Yeah, and after sweeping up at the Fringe Awards, Wellington Ballroom get the chance to impress on perhaps the biggest stage at the festival, am I right? The Wellington Airport Ngā Taniwha stage?
Yep, indeed. So, it is the biggest stage. It's not. We try and avoid main stage because right. Every stage is a main stage. Mm-hmm. But yes, Wellington Ballroom are totally extraordinary. I mean, they really blew the roof off Hannah Playhouse during the Fringe Festival. So they'll be performing on the Ngā Taniwha stage, but they'll also be doing a ball in Te Awaha on Saturday night, which is a ticketed event. But they're just not to be missed. I mean, just the dance, the extraordinary energy that Wellington Ballroom have. For listeners who don't know what ballroom is, I mean, it's basically comes out of the queer black community, and particularly in New Zealand and particularly in Wellington, Wellington Ballroom kind of form a family of performers who then perform kind of a voguing type of dance, which if you haven't ever seen it before, is just extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is worth checking out on the weekend. And Juju Lips, Hip Hop Times Strings close out the Saturday night vibes there. The New Zealand Symphony Orchestra open it on Saturday lunchtime, and much more besides. I mean, it's a really interesting it's a great stage to sort of park at, right? I mean, they're all great, but there's some real great stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, Hip Hop and Strings, for instance, was a brilliant commission that happened as part of Classical in Cuba, which is another festival that we run.
Nice.
Something that turned up at Rogan Vagabond, I think, as part of Classical in Cuba. It was absolutely packed. You couldn't get a ticket for it. And we go, okay, how can we do this again? And so it's a great opportunity for us as a festival organisation to roll things from one to the other and kind of commission those artists to do new things as well. So, everything feeds everything else.
Yeah. The Wild Workshop stage by Garage Project as well is is amazing. I think it's like Gussie Larkin has commissioned that for the day on Saturday, so check that out. Another really exciting space as well to Kōpapamāori is the Ngā Toi o Te Aro stage on the intersections of Taranaki and Dixon Streets. At least 60% of the performances are in Te Reo across the 2 days, and all acts have members who whakapapa Māori. I mean, how special and important is that to have as part of the wider festival?
Look, it's really important. And when we were looking at how we were going to celebrate Māori as part of Kupa Dupa, one of the things that Noel Wood said to me, who was working with us at the time, was we need a place to stand. And, you know, what we need to do is to kind of create a stage which is ours. Mm-hmm. Te Aro Park is the old Te Aro Pa site. So it's a very historically significant space as well. So it's the perfect opportunity to be able to, develop a program like that. And that space is programmed Māori-led as well, which is, again, is really important. Yes. And we have a wānanga space where there's an opportunity for people to be hands-on with some of the activities as well.
That's awesome. And I always remember it's one of the first spaces that I see when I approach Kupa Dupa, whether it's from Courtney or Dixon, you know. You see it first and then you kind of enter into the festival after.
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that I find, you know, if you spend enough time in the city, you get really used to spaces, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the Glover Park and there's Te Aro Park, particularly are the kind of those two key kind of inner city parks, I guess. And when Kupa Dupa's on and you close Dixon Street and you close Manus Street, mm-hmm. it becomes a different space. And when there are cars around it, it's an island. You know, and there's buses kind of going down on one side, and there's, you know, there's a real change in the way that park feels as part of Kupa Dupa, which you don't really get at any other time.
Yeah, it's quite tantalising a glimpse, isn't it, of what it could be, right?
Yes.
What are some of the big events or the parades happening in the weekend that you think we just have to be there for? I mean, I had a quick look. I saw Wellington Batucada. They're usually always fun, right? They're parading through on Saturday at 7 o'clock. There's 13 parades, though, right, across the 2 days?
Totally. And I mean, I think that's been always a very important part of what we're doing. The Batucada have always been part of Kupa Dupa, and they were also a very big part of the Kupa Street Carnival back in the day. I think the other ones that have come through are the second line, the New Orleans second line bands.
Right.
And so, you know, bands like Richter City Rebels, for example, have been very much a part of that and in the past. But we've now got three others. So there's four bands that will be doing a battle as part of Kupa Dupa. And then there'll be a mass second line performance right at the very end, which has been musically directed by Ben Hunt. I went and saw a rehearsal of that on Sunday, and it's just an extraordinary sound. Nice. I love the idea that you have these kind of mass opportunities for musicians to be able to work with each other. I mean, Sam Manzanza is putting together a really special project, within a mass Afrobeat band, drawing on the African community to come and be a part of that and the, you know, dancers as well. So, you know, those kinds of projects, I think, are really what Kupa Dupa is about.
Yeah, and you can just go and you can almost dip in and out as you wish, right? I remember just going last year and seeing this amazing street performance. I think it was Rion Bell, hanging in the sky above Kupa Street, and then going to the Mammoth and seeing some circus performances, and then going back late at night and watching some of the music. It's a great event, but it's not just the arts, is it? There's also the Kupa Dupa Street Feast, which sort of allows all the businesses in the area the chance to move out onto the street for the weekend and try something different. And there's over 30 places listed in that. That's huge in itself, right?
Yeah, no, it's massive. I mean, I think there's a couple of things that we're developing as well. So there's always been traditionally the night market that has been down at the bottom of Kupa Street. We're spreading that out this year.
Right.
And so we've got around about 40 food trucks on top of all of the businesses that are coming out onto their footpath in front of their existing premises. We've also working with a great organisation called Kai Community, or they're bringing all of the organisations that work, supplying food and repurposing and, rescuing food. And they're going to be creating five feasts down on Dixon Street, outside where Everybody Eats usually sits. Yes. So they'll have one huge, big, long table, and they'll invite 48 people to join them.
Nice. Yeah. It's going to be fantastic. I mean, when the festival is on, do you get to enjoy it yourself? What are you most looking forward to doing at Cubadoopa this weekend?
I'm really excited just to kind of soak up the whole atmosphere. It's an amazing team who work on Cubadoopa, and there's a lot of balls in the air, so there's a lot of juggling. We've been working on this for over a year, and it'll just be fantastic to see all of that come to a reality.
Yeah, well, it all happens this weekend. I'm so excited to get out and enjoy all the delights you have in store for us this weekend. Cubadoopa happens. It's all free. Head out into the Cuba area Saturday or Sunday and soak it all in, or head to cubadoopa.co.nz if you want to plan your weekend's entertainment. Drew, thanks for your time, and all the best to you and your team for the week ahead.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Now, one of the many, many artists playing this weekend, I think, is Zoe Moon. Now, let's play a track by Zoe before we get our next guests in, which is going to be Morgana O'Reilly.
I am better off in person, better off, not worse than, better off, face to face, better off in person, better off, not worse than, I'm better off, face to face. Look at me. Expectations to the inside of white rooms. I don't understand why can't we work it out? Ain't it all like a plan? Like when I pixelate, I'm like not too late to find I don't quite translate. I'm better off. Now I got your attention. I'm working on the courage to mention me. I'm a particular name, and I don't always pixelate well. Everybody's character ain't made in Black America. Oh, if you really want to know this girl, well, she's telling you to listen.
Zoe Moon in person. The time is 22 minutes past five. You are listening to 106.1 FM Wellington Access Radio. Now, Morgana O'Reilly is a well-known stage and screen actress who you may have seen over the years at home in Neighbours, Wentworth, Housebound, great film, Mean Mums and more. A Stories About My Body is a solo show where Morgana tells tales of selling her toes in New York, recalls diary entries from the late 90s while discussing boobs, birth, Perth and trying to like her chins. The show has been a huge smash already in Auckland and at Whangarei Fringe and is almost completely sold out at Circa for the remaining five performances this week. Morgana, kia ora, welcome to Access Radio.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, congratulations on the success you're enjoying with this show. I mean, how have you found the response both in audiences flocking to see it and critics and judges just raving and bestowing awards on it?
Oh, like just classically human, like on the surface, it's so great. And then underneath, I keep thinking, oh, how dare you? Like, who has the right to, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like there's this little humble girl in there that's like, oh, I'm sure everybody's had enough of it. Don't go doing it again. Gosh, shut up about it.
No, if anything, we need more. Like, I mean, like we need another 2 weeks in Wellington. Because yeah, I mean, here at least, most people, I'm guessing, will know you from the television, right, and movies. What made you want to turn your attention to the theatre and make this solo show?
Well, I think the theatre has always been my home. And I do believe as an artist, especially as an actor, and I don't want to gripe on too much about how hard it is to be an actor. Anybody who's watched anything understands the sort of the way that it works with auditions and everything like that. But I have found that to have a real sense of dignity in my work is to create my own work. And the last solo show that I made was like just over 10 years ago. I made it with the complete audacity of youth, was like, I want to travel the world, but I don't like want to get a normal job. So I'll just make a solo show and then I don't have to pay other actors. And so I did that, and I did it in people's living rooms to say thank you for letting me stay on your couch. Nice. And traveled all around with it. So it was always where I was going to come back to. And then last year was just like a genuinely hard year of lots of really ouchy rejection.
Right.
So this show kept me buoyant and kept me full, my heart full, and also paid me, which was really important.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you mentioned that it's been 10 years since you'd last made a solo show. How did you find the experience this time around? I mean, I read and you discuss in the show how, you know, walking down Waihee Beach played an important role, right?
Yeah.
Formulating ideas and the structure of the show.
Yeah, this one actually like just went blah, 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 like it had been just like sitting in me for years. I sort of had given myself allowance to make it as well, I think, because it had been such a big gap between this one and the last one. It felt kind of like the sticky second album or something. And at the start of 2021, I had this kind of revelation. It probably sounds really cheesy, but like I realized it's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. If somebody was to say, why did you make that decision? That was really crap. I don't know. And it's okay to say, I'm so sorry if it was really bad or if it offended anyone in any way, like it comes from the best place in my heart. It's okay to say both of those things. And I think that opened the floodgates to make the show that I just wanted to see. And then I worked by myself in a rehearsal space, literally talking out loud as though I was the director and performer, and would come in, do a little, my own version of a karakia, just to like set the scene, and then be like, right, so I reckon what we need to work on today, like this works good and that works good. And then often just thinking, well, what, if I was sitting in the theatre, what would I want to see? And the moments which are kind of out there in the show, and which in the rehearsal room I was like, I don't know if I should do that. And then be like, yeah, but if you were in the show, if you were in the theatre and you saw somebody do that, you'd be like, yeah. So I kept them in.
Yeah. I think it's incredibly well crafted the whole hour, right? Because it really grabs your attention at the start. And then, the energy's high. And then, yeah, you just never let go of the audience. And you're incredibly honest and vulnerable in this performance. But in a way that just felt so natural and effortless. Like, there's just this ease. And it felt, for me as an audience member, that you're really enjoying performing the show for us. So,
I am.
How much do you enjoy telling these stories?
It's so lovely. It's a really, again, this sounds really cheesy, but like it's a very, I will go as far as to say quite a spiritual thing in the set, mm-hmm. because I actually can't see people very well with the lights, but I can feel people.
Right.
I can hear them. We're all there, and it is, because it is a direct address, it's just one, it's a communication, so it's really lovely. And when I come off stage, I often feel like, oh, my chakras are open, darling. And I'm like, and I have to really fight that instinct of, as a human just to go, okay, well, that's done, and like sort of mope upstairs. But I try to sort of go, no, sit in it, like, oh, and I sing to myself for like half an hour, like, la, 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 la. because it is just like a really magical feeling of sharing that space, opening a vulnerable path to people. And I remember hearing somewhere on some friggin' podcast about stuff, health or something, that something like if you sit in a room with other people for long enough and you're all experiencing the same thing, everybody's nervous system will actually become in sync.
Wow.
And that's what it feels like at the end of the show, like we're all really in it together. You don't get that feeling of camaraderie a lot.
Yeah.
These days.
No, and
or I, ever.
Yeah, that's great, and I would totally agree with that. Yeah. But who helped you shape and craft these stories then that you wanted to tell into the finished show that we get to see at Circa? I saw in the program some really well-known artists' names like Chris Parker, Arlo Gibson, Renee Lyons all feature, all huge talents. Even a solo show takes a village, right?
Yes. So, well, first and foremost, I have to say my husband, Peter Salmon, not only creatively is an amazing force for me, questioning things, encouraging things, always encouraging. It just means the world to have a partner that is completely on board with you being an artist, especially if you're both parents. But also, sharing the load of the family, helping me with technical stuff. And then, people like Chris Parker, Mia Blake, and my beautiful bestie, Aria Jones, they all came and saw a first run of it. Mm-hmm. And so gave some really great advice on shaping. And Arlo, Aroha, they all, and Renee Lyons is huge help just for shaping and sense, you know. You get people in to see work. And also one of the things that I've learned now is inviting help in and being really specific about what the help you're needing, because too much help also can like send you down rabbit holes. But wanting to make sure it was as funny as can be, as truthful as can be, and it made sense. Like sometimes it only makes sense in your head.
Now, I don't want to go too into detail on the elements that make up the show, because you talk about them at length and people should go see it at Circa this week. But the whole selling your feet to raise funds to fly back to Aotearoa earlier in your career, that was a real eye-opener. Like, I had no idea that existed. Was that an obvious part of your life that you wanted to sort of mine and discuss in the show? Because obviously at the same time as that, some major life events happened in terms of that was when you first met your now husband and father of your kids, right?
I think so. Like, it was just, I think I've said this before somewhere, so apologies if you've ever read anything about it. But basically the show hinged on kind of three central ideas that I would sort of sometimes tell people as an anecdote. Like, one day I'm going to make, I think, feel like my next solo show is going to be like, I'm going to do this thing at the start. You know what that is. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to tell the story of working at foot fetish bars in New York City, because why else would I have done that if not to tell the story? And then also I'm noticing, because now it is like a good 12 years on, those things that you think you'll never forget and become anecdotes and stories, which I do oh so love to pull out every now and then, but they do start to go, like you start to forget them. And even for a story like this, which is now probably mostly refined to this story, although there are darker parts that nobody knows about. and then the last bit, which I talk about, birth. I was like, I'll make a solo show like that.
Well, that's it, right? I mean, in terms of stories about your body, they don't get much more
significant. I know, exactly. I was
that,
like, well, they all sort of center around that, so I'll just call it stories about my body.
Yeah, and I mean, you really do open up the window into your world and share what it was like, not only through your performance on stage, but also home videos too, right? I mean, was that an easy decision to include those as well, or did you toy with not sharing?
It was a really easy decision for the most part. There is, look, I never know whether to like say it. There is birth footage in the show, which I'm insanely proud of. Like, it's still on my phone in my favorites folder. I'll show anyone who's up for it, because I'm so proud of it. And so that was always the case. I was going to put that in there. But in one of the earlier renditions of the show, I told the story of it, but then only played the video like at the end, sort of with a dance over the top of it. And it was some of my friends who had seen it, they were like, no, you got to own that. All of the really risky stuff, even the first bit And I remember Renee Lyons being like, it's only going to work if you just go so hard out with it. You cannot shy away from it. You've got to commit, totally. So there were little moments where I was like, I don't know. But again, had gone, look, if I was sitting in the audience, I would just be so stoked to see that. So
nice. And has there been a level of catharsis for you in terms of talking about your body? Has it boosted your own self-esteem, or has doing the show improved your own relationship with your body?
I think so, because I've had to articulate it more. But also, like, up on stage is great. It's also kind of holds me more accountable. Like, I'm 37 and I've, like, contemplated a little injection here or there. I'm not going to lie. If I had heaps of money, I probably just wouldn't have even questioned it. I would have just done it. But the show has kept me accountable to that. Not that you shouldn't do it. You can do whatever you want. But just to keep questioning myself of, like, what is calling for that, and what would it achieve, just to make sure it's all going to be a nice decision in the end. But still, always, like, the hardest parts are when you're alone and you've received some disappointing news, or you're a bit hungover, or I've eaten too much wheat. I've noticed that does make me quite sad these days. So it's definitely wonderfully cathartic and helpful in a lot of ways. But nice. She's still got a shadow.
And where to next with the show? I mean, you've done the show twice in Auckland. You've done it in
Thrice in Auckland. I know, and I feel so bad. People are like, oh, are you bringing it back? I was like, guys, I've brung it back a lot. I'm sure I'm boring everybody on social media with, like, here it's going again. I've done Auckland, Taranaki, Whangarei, and I think there's a few plans afoot to bring it to a few other places, but like I was saying to you before, it's a bit of a lonely slog pushing it. And I feel like the narrative in sort of the general consciousness with arts is that somebody spots you, you know, and they like they take you places. But for the most part, that's not the case. Most of the artists, especially in New Zealand, that you mm-hmm. love, that you listen to, music, that you watch or anything, they are just slogging it out for themselves. So now I am going to try and my plan now is to, like, focus on trying to film it really good and make it a really awesome special. And then Netflix is just going to, like, want it so bad and pay me a gazillion dollars, and then it's just going to get really, really famous. And then all the theatres in the world are going to call me and be like, please, Morgana, please come. And I'll be like, okay. What do you reckon? Good plan?
Sounds like a great plan.
Seamless, watertight.
Yeah, I think it's a show that would resonate. You could take this overseas easy.
Do you know what? I'm, like, a little bit worried about taking it to New York, because people have said, would you take it to New York? And I was like, I'm just worried that I'll get in trouble for working under the table.
Someone will come to the show, right?
Do I have to add a bit about how I got a visa? But it would be a lie. This isn't recorded, right? It is. Okay, sure.
It's all
right. Just joking.
Because, I was thinking, could you envisage taking the stories about Motif and turning it into stories about motherhood or stories about your career on stage and screen?
Genius, like, yeah. I hadn't thought about that before. That's a great way to do a sequel, Simon. Thank you so much. I mean, yes, absolutely. I've been thinking about it for ages. It's my idea. And, great. Keep your ears out in 2024.
Well, look, as we go to air right now, there's only four seats left to the entire season. So drop everything. Head to circa.co.nz now and don't miss out.
There's always a couple of empty seats. Just come and hang around outside.
That's it. Get yourself on the wait really list.
Yeah.
100%. This is an awesome show. I say that as a jaded person who has seen a lot of shows in the last few weeks, but I had such a great time. So thank you so much for bringing it to Wellington.
Oh,
Stories About My Body, 7:30 Tuesday through Saturday in Circa 2. Morgana, thank you. And break a leg for the rest of the season.
Oh, break my leg so bad.
All right, we're moving over to Bats in just a few minutes. Celia McDonald and Scott Christie are here with their new show. But first, here on Access Radio, let's play some new Page with California.
I thought I'd be there by now. I'm 24, still in my parents' house. Oh, I thought I could make it out of a city where not nothing comes around. And I guess I'm still depressed. Doesn't matter how good it gets, it doesn't go away. I got myself to blame. And how high is the climb? And the stars, do they align with my cloudy brain? I got myself to blame. What's it like in California? Is it pretty? I always wonder. Or is it shitty? Like people say, it doesn't matter, 'cause I wanna make it in LA. Ooh, 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 ooh. I thought I'd be good enough. I've got the words to fill the pages up. Where's the line? Where's the time? When you're nearly 25, am I getting where I'm supposed to get? And I guess I'm still depressed. But what do you expect when the world is slowed and there's no room to grow? But how high is the climb to sunset and vine? It's cold in the shade. Gotta get away. What's it like in California? Is it pretty? I always wonder. Or is it shitty? Like people say, it doesn't matter, 'cause
the time is 20 minutes to 6. You are listening to 106.1 FM Wellington Access Radio. A big thank you there to Morgana O'Reilly, and before that Drew James from Cuba Duper. If you missed either of those chats, the podcast goes live on accessradio.org.nz tomorrow afternoon. But now we have my third and final interview. I'm really excited for this. Celia McDonald is a graduate of NASDA, the leading musical theatre training school in New Zealand. She's the writer, director and performer in A Fat Girl's Cry, a new show at BATS this week, celebrating plus size bodies on stage, performing some of Broadway's greatest hits. Celia, kia ora, welcome to Access Radio.
Kia ora, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on and making this show. When did you first have the idea to create this show?
Oh, goodness. So as part of our degree course at NASDA, we had to do a research project in our third year. And so I decided to do mine on the stigmatization against plus size actresses in professional musical theatre. So I was looking at like West End, Broadway, and how it affected New Zealand. And it kind of jumped off that like planted the seed. And then I graduated and moved back to Wellington, and I started working with children, and I was always like, I really want to put on my own show and really do something about this, because I don't think there's enough of this positive message going out. And yeah, it wasn't really till this quite awful audition experience that really kicked it off, right, and got me stuck into my studio and writing for about a year.
Was that experience here in Wellington?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Okay. So tell me, I'm sure you probably discuss it in the show, maybe?
Not really, but...
Oh, good. We don't want to give...
Yeah. I talk about some other things, but it's we do talk about auditions,
right,
and the casting panel and their opinions behind that.
Yeah.
And blind casting and all that.
For sure. So tell me about the title of the show, A Fat Girl's Cry. Why have you titled your show that?
Well, I'm fat. That's just a fact. It's personally, I don't see the word fat anymore as an insult to me. Right. I've now taken control of that word again, which is awesome. And it's just a fact about me. It's part of my genetic and my family makeup. But originally, I was just going to call it a girl's cry, because I was thinking of like, it's a cry out for help, and I didn't originally want it to be targeted on just fat.
Right.
But considering that this is something so personal and I'm so passionate about to me, that I was just like, just throw it in there, a fat girl's cry, because then it's just a cry, it's more of a cry out rather than like depression crying.
Right.
it's a bit more of a more reaching out sort of one. It's more gripping than it is like, oh, I don't want to go see someone cry on stage for an hour.
for sure. And I mean, as a talented triple threat who's done their training, how have you found the traditional stereotypes or close-minded views of some in the industry towards what defines a romantic leading lady?
Mm-hmm. So particularly while I was at drama school, it's very influenced there, because you have a set cast. You just have to assign the roles for whatever musical or play you're doing to whoever suits it best, because that's the skills that we have then. But the one thing I felt was we were all very stuck in our stereotypes, and we weren't able to explore and expand our skills as much as we possibly could have if we were given the chance to explore those roles that were not so much conventionally chosen or looked at to do. But it's also very influenced by, especially overseas in America, it is all very influenced from over there, because you've seen it for many, many years. And it's in movies, media, fashion industry. It's just part of the culture now and within our society, and it's very hard to escape from it. So it's not surprising that it's influenced what we see on stage.
Yeah. And I mean, what sort of impact does that have on a person's mental health, right, or their relationship with their body?
Mm. So the wonderful thing about this show is that you can translate it to any other underserved diversity,
mm-hmm.
But particularly for plus size, when you see the certain characters that you see as plus size, usually they're the comedic relief or a villain, or they're not as intelligent as others. When you see that, especially growing up in Disney films and stuff, that you translate that into real life, and it's just a vicious cycle, because you see it when you're little in those movies and what they casted then, you take it into real life, and then if you go to do those castings, whether it be for fashion, media, movies, theatre, film, anything, you will have that mindset already installed in you. And when you don't see enough of that positive representation, you start to feel very isolated, and you become something that you start to hate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I found that when I was younger, I was always looking for, I loved ballet when I was little. I was always looking for a plus size ballerina or something there, but no, because ballerinas have to be skinny and small, because that's how it's been for over 100 years and everything. But now there's a Disney short called Reflect, which is about a ballerina who struggles with body dysmorphia,
mm-hmm.
and she is a plus size ballerina, and you see all these like cracking mirrors and just how it affects her. And if I had something like that when I was little, I would have kept up with ballet longer than I probably did. I did ballet from ages 3 to 13, but then stopped because I was very body conscious.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of Lizzo as you were talking about that, yeah. as well. And yeah.
Love Lizzo.
We stand Lizzo. So yeah, I mean, as you mentioned there, yeah, about, you know, often plus size bodies may be the leading lady's comedic relief friend in musical theatre and movies and all the rest of it. Because I was thinking, yeah, there's Tracy Turnblad, right? The lead in Hairspray. But
who else?
Exactly, right? I mean, because for you, what are some of the roles that do exist out there that you would love to play?
Oh, well, there's lots of roles I love to play. One of them particularly is Nancy from Oliver, because yeah. she's just been one of my dream roles ever since I was like 8 when I saw the musical on the West End with Jodie Pringer, who is also a plus size woman. Mm-hmm. But she's just a lovely, just motherly character, and she's got gorgeous songs and a gorgeous heart. But there's also roles like Eponine in Les Mis. Traditionally, she is seen as small because it's France, it's all the French Revolution, and that she's supposed to be starving and all. And so typically she's been cast as small. But if you look into her storyline as a character and her plotline, that is essentially what every single plus-size woman I've ever met has gone through. Mm-hmm. So why can't we see a plus-size Eponine on stage? It would only make the story so much more richer and more relatable, because there's that representation. And us plus-size girls, we know what that feels like when she gets rejected by the guy that she has been loving for years, for this skinny blonde girl who's a soprano. Mm-hmm. Like, that's also every alto as well. Every single alto knows exactly what that is like. And, I mean, if you look at Madame Thénardier, she's mm-hmm. usually cast as a plus-size woman. Why can't it be genetic mm-hmm. and have Eponine as plus-size? I don't know.
No. Well, with that in mind, let's talk about the show.
Yes.
How have you gone about sort of structuring and crafting the show? What's the sort of journey you're aiming to take audiences on with this?
Mm-hmm. So I was very careful with the songs that I chose, because not only did I want to use the songs from musicals that I love and I cherish, but also how can I take the stories of the song out of context and put them into this fresh new context? So particularly one of the songs that I sing is Children Will Listen from Into the Woods. Mm-hmm. And I'm a teacher. I'm a performing arts teacher now. And I used to do a after-school musical theatre program when I was little. And considering what I've heard from teachers say to me then and how that's influenced me growing up, I now take that into consideration with my teaching. And so just singing Children Will Listen is just a beautiful way for me to help express that emotion. As well as there are other songs like I'm the Greatest Star from Funny Girl.
Nice.
And it's taking a bit of a mick of myself, and also it's where I can be a little bit cocky. And it also touches base on everything that happened with the Funny Girl revival on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it touches on a whole bunch of things, but then ends very, very solemnly and very thought-provoking.
Right.
And I've got a couple of pop songs in there as well, so it's not just musical theatre.
Nice. And you do, I think there's a few mentioned in the publicity that I'm excited for. Wicked, of course, Chicago, yep. Hairspray, mm-hmm. Can you drop any of the tracks that we might hear from those? Keeping those a secret.
We may have a lovely little romantic duet in there.
Nice.
We may have a little bit of welcome to date. We may have a little bit of that.
Okay. I don't think we know what that is.
Yeah.
Because who else have you got involved with you on this show?
So obviously I've got one of my best friends in the world, Scott Christie, who I have flown up from Christchurch specifically to do this show with me. They have been one of my best friends throughout NASDA.
Nice.
I've also got Jess Weston, who mm-hmm. is a third year at Te Awaha. So they are my stage manager and one of my actors, and they only just learnt the show yesterday and today, because it was a last minute switch out in casting. So that was amazing. And they're doing fantastic. And we have a live pianist, Laura Stone, who is a music student at Vic.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And what's your great hope for this? How do you hope audiences who come on this journey with you, how do you hope they leave the theatre feeling, or what do you hope this show makes them talk about after they leave the theatre?
Well, I hope when people leave the show that they feel empowered and more in love with themselves and with the craft of musical theatre and music and dancing, and with that newfound idea of how we can stretch these different stories, and that everyone's story is worthy of telling,
mm-hmm.
and how can we put that out into the world so then the next generation doesn't have to grow up with these burdens in our brains and all these, I don't know what to say, but all these barriers as well that we need push.
Yeah.
And some people may not like it. Some people may think it's really uncomfortable, but I think it's incredibly important that we do, because otherwise there's not going to be any change.
That's it. You got to put it out there. You got to normalize it. You got to celebrate it.
Yeah.
That's that. I mean, it's the same with all these other things, right? But especially, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, look, I wish you all the very best with this. A Fat Girl's Cry opens at Bats Theatre on Wednesday night. It runs for 5 performances only, 7:30 p.m. Each night until Saturday, and a bonus matinee at 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoon as well. Celia, thank you so much for coming in, and break a leg for opening night. I hope it goes really well.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all we have time for on tonight's C-Zone. A big thank you to all of my guests. We'll be back next Monday, same time, same place. We're going to be joined by Andrea Sanders. You'll know her from the Beat Girls. They're going to be doing Cringeworthy, the 60s at Circa Theatre from the start of next month. We're also joined by Paul Potts, who is starring in 50 Golden Years of Musicals, celebrating 50 years of the Stetson Group, Stuart and Tricia McPherson. They're going to be joining me in a few weeks' time on the show as well. So tune in for that. Same time, 5 o'clock next Monday. Ekashwani is on the way next. Before that, I'm not sure if this is going to be in the show, but I'm going to play As Long As He Needs Me from Oliver here on XS Radio. Thank you and have a great week.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.